We are very much being dragged into the culture wars. As a community, we're being dragged into making these very sort of black and white decisions. Are we on this side of the progressive divide? Are we on this side of the progressive divide? Part of what we should be bringing to the table, I think we can bring to the table, is to say, actually, let's take the issue on its merits. Let's look at and whether it's going to be around the position of spiritual leadership for women within religious communities, whether it's how we deal or cope with or accept or otherwise members of our community who may be LGBT, how we are reflecting relationship to academia or that type of scientific-based research versus Torah-based research. And there are a whole stream of communal and other debates where we have to be able to look at them on its merits and not just say, well, I happen to be in a particular camp, and therefore that's going to derive from there how I'm going to look at that issue.
I'm Scott Kahn, and this is the Orthodox Conundrum. This is the Orthodox Conundrum on JewishCoffeeHouse.com. I'm Scott Kahn. Last week's episode of this podcast was supposed to be a wide-ranging conversation about the present and future of religious Zionism, including a discussion of our relationship with the Palestinian population in Yehuda Veshomron and Gaza. As I mentioned then, we ended up spending the entire podcast speaking about that one issue. So I invited my guests, Daniel Goldman and Rabbi Elie Michel, to come back this week to discuss the topics that we had failed to address. As it turns out, that episode generated an unusual amount of feedback, both positive and negative. In particular, Rabbi Elie Michel's ideas were the subject of numerous comments, both public and private. And I understand why people were upset. Some of what he said would have, at one time, been seen as outside the realm of acceptable ideas. Most obviously, when he suggested that while it's not practical now, our best solution is to take those Palestinians in the territories who support Hamas's actions on October 7th and expel them altogether from the country. Frankly, I disagree strongly with his approach. In my Substack, Orthodox Conundrum Commentary, I've written articles explaining why I think that these ideas are completely unacceptable. Nonetheless, it's clear that ideas like transfer have become more and more mainstream in the national religious world, particularly after October 7th. Pretending that they don't exist might be an attractive option for some, but is, I think, a way of burying our heads in the sand. We may disagree with these ideas, but they're mainstream enough that we can't simply ignore them altogether. If we disagree with them, we need to confront them and say why we think that they're wrong. As a result of that feedback, I decided to dedicate the first part of this episode to further clarifying Elie and Daniel's opinions about some of the hot-button topics we talked about last week regarding the Palestinians. The majority of the podcast then addresses other subjects that are directly relevant to religious Zionists, including questions regarding the culture wars, how we as a community should relate to non-Orthodox Jews, our attitudes towards the many ultra-Orthodox people who refuse to serve in the IDF, whether political religious Zionism is going in a positive direction, if there should be a separation of Torah and state, and more. We'll begin that conversation in just a moment. First, let me remind you to subscribe to the Orthodox Conundrum podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and please rate it and write a review. Please subscribe to my Substack, Orthodox Conundrum Commentary. Last week, I released two articles. The first, How to Not Make the Torah Great and Glorious, describes a way that the election campaign of the new religious mayor of Beit Shemesh violated a Torah prohibition, and the fact that we're better off losing elections than winning them in the name of Torah while making a mockery of the Torah. The second is, What Do You Have to Do with These Secrets of God?, where I analyze a passage from Masechet Brachot, which, I believe, shows a real flaw in the thinking of some people who argue against ultra-Orthodox military conscription. The link is in the description of this podcast, so get your free subscription today. And finally, remember that JCH Podcast Productions is the best place for you to go in order to produce your podcast from start to finish. Write to me at scott@jewishcoffeehouse.com so that we can discuss helping you make a high-quality, professional, and popular podcast. Rabbi Elie Michel is the Director of Education at Israel 365, where he works to build bridges between Jews and Christians in support of Israel, and he's the editor of HaMizrahi magazine. Before making Aliyah, he served as the rabbi of Congregation Suburban Torah in Livingston, New Jersey. Daniel Goldman is the founding partner of Gold Rock Capital and founder of the Institute for Jewish and Zionist Research. He is a businessman and social activist. He currently co-chairs the Coalition for Haredi Employment and is a former chair of Gesher and World B'nai Akiva.
Daniel Goldman and Rabbi Elie Michel, thank you again for joining me on the Orthodox Conundrum podcast.
Great to be here.
Excellent to be here.
As I mentioned in my introduction, there was a lot of feedback that I received regarding last week's episode, some very positive and some very negative. So before anything else, I want to ask you both if there's anything that you said on the last episode that you would like to take back. Sometimes on podcasts, people say things in the moment and they say, oh, I wish I could have phrased that differently or said it differently. Or are you fine with what you said? And it could be that you don't remember exactly what you said, which is fine as well. Elie, let's start with you. What's your feeling about that?
No, I feel pretty comfortable with what I said. I'm happy to talk more about it.
How about you, Daniel?
Yeah, I actually one interesting piece of feedback that I got came via a post that Rav Yelayahu Fran, I think on Friday or Thursday, posted about the kerfuffle with regards to what the Rosh Yeshiva in Yafo had said. And actually, it somewhat reflected, I think, the discussion that we'd had ourselves on the podcast about what actually he was referring to in the shiur and how it related to possibly the difference or some type of gap between what he felt would be the sort of ideal or halachic response and the sort of practicalities of dinah d'malchut hadinah. And I think it was actually a good reflection of our conversation. I got mostly positive feedback, and actually one of my neighbors here who his kids actually go to Yafo, he was the one who sent me the post from Eli. And actually, you know, thinking about it, maybe, I don't know what you have in store for us this evening. Obviously, I've been thinking about our previous conversation and what we might move ahead to talk about. But I do think that the question with respect to Yudav Shomron and Gaza and so forth is just one aspect, obviously, of a wider, possibly deeper, but definitely wider debate as to which direction we're going in as a community and what other points will be worth drawing out in terms of what the challenges are or some level of difference between social attitudes and religious attitudes on the one hand and political ones on the other. And I think whilst I really enjoyed the conversation last week with Elie on those other topics, I'm excited to get into some other issues tonight.
And we will do that. I first want to speak a little bit more about last week's episode, only because a lot of people were very, let's say, excited about it in a positive or a negative sense. So let me give you an example of one thing that I was thinking about in response to some of the feedback that I received. It relates directly to an episode I released on January 1st with Rabbi Shlomo Brody entitled The Ethics of War, Torah Values, and the IDF. Is the Israeli army actually the most moral army in the world? And in that episode, he argued, and I don't want to speak for him, but this is how I understood what he said. People can listen to it and see if they agree. He argued that in the ethics of war, he was speaking about a Torah perspective, of course. It includes the idea that if we don't want others to do something to us, we can't do it to them. In other words, let's speak about what you said, Rav Elie, in terms of transferring the population which is hostile to Israel. You mentioned that 83% of Palestinians have been polled and say they agree with what happened on October 7th. Now, the question is this. If transfer is the right solution, that means we have to say that if someone were to do it to us, according to this logic, then we'd be okay with that too. And say, if we were hostile to a country, let's say, for example, this were Palestine now, let's say this were the year 1945, and instead of Israel, a state of Palestine had been created after World War II. And we were trying to create a state of Israel, and they decided to kick us out as a result. According to Rabbi Brody, or at least as I understand Rabbi Brody, that would be ethically okay, only if we'll do it to them and they'll do it to us. The implication is obviously that we would find it an ethical monstrosity should they do it to us, and accordingly, it's an ethical monstrosity should we propose doing it to them. How would you deal with this particular issue in terms of ethics of war? You might say that you don't agree with that ethic, but how would you deal with it?
Let's first reiterate here who these people are, okay? And I think that's important to remember. You know, we talk about numbers. Barry Weiss, you know, the well-known journalist, she was in Yehuda and Shomron, Judea Samaria. She asked, you know, an Arab about October 7th. And he said, you know, laughing about the slaughter of October 7th, he said, most people agree with what happened on the 7th of October. 70% agree. There's no discussion. The other 30% agree in their hearts, but they do not announce it. And he's laughing. And he goes, I'm 101%. So I think it's time that we have to recognize reality. People are really, really struggling to accept this. The fact that these Arabs, and I don't even want to say Palestinians, but that's a whole other conversation, but it's a fake name and it's we shouldn't be calling them Palestinians. But these Arabs overwhelmingly support the murder of Jews. Now, to answer your question, let's try to imagine it this way. Right, let's imagine that in the United States, in the state of Texas, right, let's say there are some several million people living in Texas who refused to accept American sovereignty, and they've made it their goal to topple the U.S. government, and not just topple the U.S. government, but to rid America of all Americans. Now, where are they all going to go, right? They're going to have to go into the sea, into the oceans, meaning we're going to slaughter them. And then not only do they say that, but then they actively support the murder of Americans. And and imagine they've slaughtered thousands of Americans over the last several decades. Now, what would America do? What would America do in that situation? Could any country, any sovereign nation abide, right, a people like this, some millions of these kinds of people who are actively working to tear down their government, right? This is, I think, so obvious and so clear. America is unbelievably hypocritical, right? Chuck Schumer, the Shomer Yisrael, and the way that he spoke this week, the sickening words that he shared in the Senate and telling Israel as if we're a banana republic, what we should be doing and who we should be voting for. He had no conception as to what the Israeli people actually believe. But just think of the hypocrisy of America, you know, constantly moralizing towards us and telling us how terrible we are towards these Arabs. Right? Could you imagine if this was the case in Texas? What would America do if they slaughtered several thousand Texans? Several thousand, not just on one day, but for decades. And so I think that the way that they would respond is, you don't like it here? Well, get out. And if you're not going to leave, we're going to get you out of here. We will find another place for you to go. You can, if you want to be here, you want to be loyal American citizens, you want to serve in the army, you want to pay taxes, you want to be peaceful people, we're happy to have you. And I've said the exact same thing. Any Arab who wants to be here and wants to be part of it and wants to be peaceful, wonderful. But the vast majority have made it extremely clear. And if people are denying that fact, and it is a fact, right, they are shoving their heads in the sand. I know that we would like it to be otherwise. We really would like it to be otherwise. We would love to have wonderful Arabs, our cousins, Ishmael and Israel, living together side by side. It would be wonderful, but that's not the reality. It's not the reality. We have to listen, right, and learn the lesson from Sarah Imenu. Right, what happened? Yishmael, right, was mitzachek, right? And the rabbis tell us that he was really trying to kill Yitzchak. Now, he hadn't killed anyone yet. He hadn't actually killed Yitzchak, but he was trying to kill Yitzchak. And so Sarah said to Avraham, right, that we get rid of him, right? You have to send him out of here. Now, Avraham responded, right? The words there are very powerful. The matter was very evil in Avraham's eyes. The matter was very evil in his eyes, right? It's very painful for Jews who are loving and amazing people like Avraham Avinu. It's very, very hard to do that, to take Ishmael and send him away. Because that's not who we are. We don't want to do things like that. But what did Hashem say? Your wife is right. Sarah is right. You, Avraham, are wrong. And so I say today, we have Avraham Jews who are well-meaning, wonderful people. Right? And they want to live in a world where the Arabs here are loving and kind and wonderful people who want peace. And so they can't accept the reality. But we have to listen to the Sarah Jews who are saying enough slaughtered Jews, enough already. Right, we've already given enough of our sons and our daughters, right, to terrorism. It's time for these people to go.
Okay, thank you for explaining that. I'm sure some people would say that there's a difference, given that Avraham was then answered by God himself, absent a divine fiat, then Avraham might have been right, because he was responding to the natural ethical thing, and God said this is an exception, and absent that sort of prophetic inspiration, then we can't act on the assumption that God would agree with us.
We may not have prophetic inspiration, but we have thousands and thousands of dead Jews. Slaughtered Jews. And to me, that's enough. And I think that we've been given the Torah specifically to learn from it, right? If we say that it's not relevant because we don't have prophetic inspirations, and what's the point of giving drashas on Shabbos? What are the rabbis doing all throughout America and all these different shuls if we can't learn anything from the Torah? To me, this is the clearest possible lesson that we could be learning. And remember, in that case, Yishmael had not yet done anything. He had not yet actually killed anyone, right? We have facts, and we have many, many dead Jews, and I don't want to see any more.
Daniel, how would you respond to what Ravelli said?
I certainly agree with the last sentence. We don't want to see any more dead Jews. I don't think I want to relitigate what we did last week. And I don't really have any hermeneutic explanation as to why the end of the story with Avram, Ishmael, and Yitzchak reunite to bury him. So maybe we could discuss that at another date. But I think each of us made the points clear the last time we met. So I'd rather move on and try something else.
Okay, that's totally reasonable. Then let me ask another question. Again, in the service of trying to understand and close up shop from last week and making sure that we don't leave any loose ends, Ellie, I want to ask you a theoretical question. You might say it's not possible, and maybe you're right. Last time you talked about re-education that would happen in theory, the same way that when the Germans and Japanese were completely destroyed by the Allies, there was a possibility of reinvigorating their society with Western values. In a similar way, some would argue that should Hamas be completely defeated, at least in theory, and a process of re-education were initiated, we could then live in peace with the Palestinians by changing the way they think. I don't think there's any reason to think the Palestinians are fundamentally different from the Germans in terms of their ability to change their attitude, change the way they think about Jews. Now, let's say in theory that that were to happen. Let's say, for example, Hamas were to be defeated, decimated, and Israel and the West initiated some sort of re-education program, call it what you will, so that now the Palestinian society is reformed and no longer harbors that same hatred of Jews. And now we have however many Palestinian citizens who are okay with living with Israel. They just want citizenship. And that means they could vote Israel out of existence. What would you respond to that? What's the answer to that kind of situation?
Well, first of all, a couple of points, meaning Nazi Germany and Japan, they were not, it wasn't like we just defeated the Nazi party. Right, Dresden was destroyed. City after city were completely destroyed. Not just Dresden, many, many, many others. How many hundreds of thousands? I don't know the exact number of average Germans were slaughtered. We know what happened in Japan. It was a complete and utter defeat of these nations in a way that completely broke them and shattered them. I think, you know, if Israel were to do such a thing, right? Can you imagine today if we would do that? If we would go ahead and do what America did to Japan and Germany, right? That would be, right? Chuck Schumer might actually die of a heart attack on the Senate floor. He'd be so apoplectic, right? I mean, he'd be out of control. So I'm not really sure that we can actually re-educate simply by taking out a bunch of terrorists when essentially the rest of this, of them are terrorists in waiting. They need to be defeated entirely and utterly. Now, the more humane thing would be, I think, simply just to send them elsewhere. Right, as opposed to turning Gaza into Dresden, let's just get the Arabs out of Gaza and send them elsewhere and get them set up in a proper way. I think that would actually be a lot more humane than doing what America did to Japan or to Germany. That being said, you asked me another question, which is if Arabs can be re-educated, can they have citizenship? So I'm skeptical as to whether they can be re-educated, meaning all of them. I think that there's a percentage of them who can be, that maybe that 15% that don't celebrate October 7th. And I do think that down the road, there should be a path potentially for citizenship. On the other hand, if there are millions of Arabs who are remaining here, right, then full-on citizenship with full-on national voting rights, as I think we discussed last time, would destroy Israel as a Jewish state. And so obviously that cannot happen. But if we were to transfer a majority of these Arabs because they are terror supporting people who want to murder Jews, and there's a minority that remains who want to be full on citizens and serve in the army and wonderful, you know, right? So then I think there should be a path, yes, for citizenship.
I'll just really make one simple comment. In many ways, what Ellie, I think, reflects is a major shift, and it's not 100% clear to me how much this is reflected within the mainstream of the Dati community, and we can certainly talk about that. But I think that means that what was, I think, for many, many decades considered to be a completely off-limits political position is making its way into the into at least parts of the mainstream. My personal view on that is that that is an acceptance of Kahanism, effectively, or at least a version of that. And until 2 to 3 years ago, that was considered to be basically completely mukta. It could be that Ellie would claim that circumstances have changed and therefore we have to adapt that accordingly. I find that a very difficult position. I would hope that position is reflected in large parts of the religious community, but I have concerns that due to the populism of people like Ben-Gvir and others is actually gaining a foothold. And even though for years it was outside of the camp, Unfortunately, people like Rav Drukman, Zichron Elibracha, and others have empowered that due to specific political considerations, which again, I think are part of what we should be talking about this evening. And as a result, and ironically now, Ben-Gvir is now, at least if you could believe the polls, which seem to repeat themselves on a regular occasion, he is now much more politically, potentially at least, particularly strong relative to even Bezalel Smotrich, who is under any other definition, certainly on the right or the, you know, the more hard right part of the religious community. So one may think that's progress. I certainly don't.
Okay, we're going to get to that issue soon, and I do appreciate the ability to and the opportunity to speak about other issues too. I just want to make sure that we cover another couple things quickly before we finish up. Let me ask another question to you, Ellie, because I am curious about this. This is something which really has, in some ways, been bothering me. I don't have an answer to it. The people who are driving the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish activity in the Arab world, specifically in Hamas, in Islamic Jihad, in Iran, obviously, I am fully on board with the fact that they are evil people, their activities and their speech and everything about what they're doing is 100% Nazi-like. I don't want there to be any misunderstanding of what I'm saying. The reason they're doing this is because they believe in a book. They believe that the Quran is divinely inspired. They believe it was given to them by God. Lahavdil, but the way that we feel about the Torah with us. Now, you use, as Orthodox Jews should, the Torah as a guide for action. They use the Quran as a guide for action, according to their understanding of the Quran. So I'm going to ask a strange question, and perhaps it's unanswerable, but in your opinion, is the only difference between us and them is that our book is right and their book is wrong, so to speak?
So certainly their book is wrong. I actually, you know, I'm going to say something now that maybe it'll blow Daniel's mind. I really believe that right now we are experiencing world war over the Torah, over the Bible. Meaning we have enemies now who are very strange bedfellows. We have Islamists, very pity. We have these people who believe in the Quran and who reject the Torah, right? And that's an important thing to recognize. There's a big difference between Christians and Muslims. On the one hand, Muslims have a cleaner theology from a Jewish perspective, right? They believe in one God and they don't believe that a man is a God. So in that sense, you know, Muslims are better, in a sense, their religion than Christianity. But in another sense, it's much worse because Christianity, right? Christians believe that God gave the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. And so there's a distinction here, right? The Rambam says that even though he was no fan of Christianity, he says that we can study Torah with Christians because they share a reverence for the Torah. And so by learning with them, you know, we can share our views with them and perhaps maybe they'll come to see it our way. But with Muslims, you can't study the Torah because they don't share a reverence for it, and they're only going to use it against us. And so I think, you know, where we are in history right now, where Christians have come, in general, come closer to the Jewish people, you know, it's a battle now between Jews and Christians on the one hand and Muslims on the other. And it's really a battle over the Bible, right? They reject our Bible. They stole many of the stories from it. I have really very, very little respect for the Quran, which that's me personally, and maybe you know, others would disagree. I'm no great expert on it, but given, you know, what it stole from Torah and what it says about Jews in their Quran, which is that I've read a lot about, is quite disturbing. And on the other hand, you know, together with these Muslims, we find like these, you know, angry secular woke progressives who are our major enemies, you know, in America today. And why do we have queers for Palestine? It's very strange, right? If they would go, we know that if they would go to Gaza, they'd probably be dead in 5 minutes. So why are they supporting them? I think it's simply because they also hate the Bible. They also hate the Torah. And, you know, from a different angle, they're secular. They don't believe, right? But they don't like, neither they nor the Muslims like the restrictions, the ethics, the morality of the Torah. And so I do think that we are now in a world war against our Torah. To see this as like some sort of nationalistic war is frankly to put your head in the sand. They called this war the Al-Aqsa Flood. This is a war of Islam, admittedly an extremer form of Islam, right? There are Muslims out there that have made changes, right? Like in the UAE, right? That is the model. That's like the one great hope for the Muslim world, right? And we owe them, you know, great respect and thanks for making those changes. But overall, I think that we see that the majority of Muslims in the world are supporting our enemies. And that's frightening, right? There are hundreds of thousands of Muslims that are screaming and yelling on the streets of London. I think it was 300,000 of them who were there, right? That's something that we cannot, you know, blind ourselves to. This is not just Hamas. This is not just Hezbollah. This is much, much bigger. And I think it is possible that, of course, we should, with all due humility, we don't really know, but it is possible that this is part of the whole final Gogu Magog war that it talks about in Tanakh. That may very well be.
Daniel, do you want to add anything, or are you satisfied to let things lie?
Maybe one very, it's probably well above my pay grade, to be perfectly honest. But I'm glad, first of all, that Ellie points out that there does seem to be, and it may be right now, a minority stream, or seemingly, right, minority stream within Islam that is trying to look at the Abrahamic religions in a more accommodating fashion than we certainly see with our neighbors. I think if we're religious people, we have to pray that becomes a much stronger part of, you know, Islamic society. And I pray for lots of things, but that's definitely one of them. I'm also reminded, and I'd have to look it up, so I apologize for not being accurate about this. I remember some years ago, there was the head of one of the major other Islamic groups, which I think they came from Indonesia, actually, who came to Israel, and there was a major Kululam, and he was representing many hundreds of millions of Muslims who was looking for a more accommodative interfaith dialogue. And yeah, unfortunately, in our particular neighborhood, I think the three of us can understand and agree that at the moment, the ascendancy is with this extreme and violent form of jihadist Islam, which must be and has to be fought in order to, at the base level, you know, protect our existence. And if Ellie is correct, then there is wider global, maybe even cosmic aspects to it. I think the other thing which Ellie raises, which is troubling and definitely needs thought, is this connection of the extremes. And by the way, interestingly, if you look at it, it's multiple extremes which are gathering together, particularly after the 7th of October, where the sort of what seemed to up to now have been sort of culture wars have sort of finally converged on our own little private war here in the Middle East. To me, actually, that's not a great surprise, and it's not something that I was surprised at all. I think there is also a kind of recalibration of that thought about what often is called woke, or the sort of radical progressive politics. I think we will probably see a recalibration within the Western countries around that. And I'm hoping that there will be an ability to parse away the red-green alliance that Ellie's speaking about. But right now, we're definitely not on the uptick of that. We're more on the downtick. And again, if we have time to talk about it, I think the convergence of the sort of culture politics and countercultural, progressive, radical progressive versus, you know, conservative or radical conservative on the other side, what's going on in America with the sort of Christianization of the right wing and parts of the radical right wing of the Republican Party, and also to a certain degree what here is termed the Machane Emuni, the sort of faith camp, which has kind of developed also as a political or identity construct within society here. Those are super interesting and powerful forces. And I think just in the same way as left-wing politics got caught up in identity politics, I think it would be, and I think that's a disaster. I think it would be very bad for us if we got caught up on the other side of that, having to fix our political opinions based around a particular, you know, religious or other identity. So I'd love to get into some of that. And I think it's reflected actually well in some of the internal debates within the religious community. It's complicated. So I'd love to get into some of that.
So let's get into that right now. I said I had two more questions. I realized that we could keep going all night long. So I'll have to call it here, even though I have more I'd like to ask about that, maybe some other time. So let me ask you, Daniel, about those culture wars. The culture around us here in Israel, as well as across the world, is changing very fast. And as those who regard themselves as the vanguards of both religiosity and integration into Israeli society, we religious Zionists will inevitably be affected by this. Our world is going to change. So my question is, should religious Zionist Jews actively engage in these culture wars? Should we accept lifestyles, for example, that are apparently antithetical to Torah, even though we disagree with them? Or on the other hand, should we actively fight against the culture accepting them? Should we perhaps ignore the culture wars altogether and essentially let others get involved and we'll stay in our Batei Midrash and not really become part of that fight?
So I think as a point of principle, and I think also from an educational point of view, which is perhaps no less and maybe more important than the principle view, is I think that the general ethos, or at least the ethos of religious Zionism that I grew up on, was to be engaged with the world, understanding a priori that is a complicated task. And one of the things which separates us from the ultra-Orthodox of the Haredi world is that we do not set up to put the walls in place that keep all types of threats, mostly modern threats, out. And I think that ultimately this is a deep choice that we make as religious Zionists or modern Orthodox people for outside of Israel. Clearly, that makes a much more complex interaction with that modernity, because the ability to say everything that is out there, which is basically negative, and everything within the walled garden is positive, in some ways is a more simple educational or societal message. And the ability to parse what we engage with and what we reject is obviously a much more difficult educational exercise. So I think as a point of principle, we are in that game. We've made that decision whether we like it or not. And I think those who choose to leave the religious Zionist community will probably often do so for the reason that they actually don't want to cope with that complicated question. And it can go, of course, in either direction. We see lots of people who leave the religious Zionist community become effectively Haredi, or as kind of Zionist version of Haredi Judaism, where the wall goes up and insulation becomes a value in and of itself. And of course, many people leave the religious community in order to engage in a more secular, or at least a traditional lifestyle, where that commitment to halakha becomes less of a challenge in terms of how to deal between modernity and tradition. So I think in principle, before we get into the meat and potatoes of what that means, I think we're in that game whether we like it or not.
Okay, Ravelli, what do you think in terms of integration, rejection, or acceptance? What's your feeling, or staying far away?
Look, I would agree that politics is life, and all these matters. We're not charedim, and everything that happens in society is our business, and our ultimate goal is a Torah society. That's what we want. I think every religious Zionist agrees with that. Now, how to go about doing it? I'm not sure that it has to be culture wars. I don't think that we need to be that we need to choose either or, that we have to, like, we're not in this, but if we're in it, we're going to be going and fighting with people. I think Rav Kook's approach, he said, ma'at min ha'or dofeh harbe min ha'choshech, that a little bit of light, can get rid of a lot of darkness. And so, yes, we should make our positions clear. There are many things that we cannot accept that the modern world, champions, and we can express the fact that we disagree with that, and we should say that, and we should be clear about that. But to do so in a way that's filled with love, that's absolutely required. And I think, I try to look to Tanakh, as I've made clear, in the last episode and this one as well, for my guidance on these matters. And I think, we look to David HaMelech as our hero. And on the one hand, David HaMelech was incredibly strong and tough against our enemies. But when it comes to the internal matters of the Jewish people, David HaMelech was not harsh. And he was incredibly forgiving. He was, even towards the people who tried to kill him previously, he was trying to work together and find a way to bring the Jewish people together. So the way to do that is not by engaging culture wars. That is absolutely not our goal. So we have to make our positions clear. We have to teach and teach and teach some more, and teach with a lot of love. So I guess I'll give you one example. You didn't ask for this, but, the whole issue of non-Orthodox Jews at the Kotel. There are some religious Zionists who take the approach that, we're going to go there and try and get in their way and, force a mechitza there and so on. And then you have some people like Rav Melamed who argue, you should stand there and hold a sitter and give it to the Reform Jews who are coming. So maybe this surprises Daniel, I don't know. But on this matter, when the internal issues, I think Rav Melamed is the way forward. I think that's the path of Rav Kook. And as strong as we have to be against those who are trying to kill us, we have to be, I wouldn't say flexible, right, in the sense that we have to bend our views. But I do think that we have to be filled with love, sort of like the way Chabad works, you know, all around the world, where they don't in any way bend anything that they believe, right? They are who they are. They dress the way that they dress. And if you come into a Chabad house, you're following, you know, what the Chabad rules are. But somehow, everybody loves Chabad. And I think that that has to be the model for the religious Zionist world as well.
Well, that's an interesting example you gave with Rav Melamed in the Kotel, because at least as I understand Rav Melamed, he was not suggesting in his metaphorical way that you should hold the Siddur for a Reformed Jew standing in, if he's a man, the men's section, or a woman in the women's section. He was instead referring to encouraging them to daven in the Mechitza free section, which does not accord with Orthodox halacha. So in that sense, it's very not like Chabad.
Right, that's a good point. Maybe he goes a little bit further than what Chabad would do. But I think that that was a very powerful point, right? Which is, yes, we don't agree. I think Rav Melamed, and he does make very clear in his writings, right, that he's not comfortable with the way that they daven, with the sitter that they use, or with the lack of a mechitza, or any of those things, right? So he makes that extremely clear, but he's trying to make a point that at the same time, right, we have to show such love to them that we would even hold the sitter for them as they come in. I don't think he was trying to say that we should be encouraging people to be reformed. I don't think that's what his point was. I think he was trying to make a point that, because if you look at the rest of that article that he wrote, he was very clear about what we believe. And I think that has to be our path. I really, maybe that has, you know, maybe my feelings on this matter are due to the fact that I come from America, which is a very different world than Israeli religious Zionism. And perhaps that has softened me on that front. But I think that it's not just me. I think that was Rav Kook. That was his whole life. And that's how he dealt with people who were different from him. And it worked.
First of all, completely agree with Ellie on this point. And I think Rav Melamed enjoys a certain independence of view within our sort of rabbinic community, which has allowed him to take this position. And I think actually leadership and bravery, to be perfectly honest. And again, for our listeners or viewers that are not familiar, over the last 2 to 3 years, perhaps due to some of these, some would consider to be controversial views, there have been serious attacks on his halachic credibility, attempts to actually ban his series of books on halacha to the extent of taking it out of certain batei midrash, or somebody should write a competitive compendium so that we don't have to rely on Rav Melamed. I believe he has other volumes that are in the works, which are going to, I think, deepen and continue this debate around Gior. But I think ultimately, where I would agree completely with Ellie is the position that Rav Melamed takes is actually relatively simple. I do not need to agree with my interlocutor in order to have a constructive Jewish conversation with them. And whether that be a female Reform rabbi from France or as Ellie pointed out, a view around a more positive view as to people coming to the Kotel, to Davin, in a way which he would absolutely never give countenance towards for himself or his followers, I think expresses a sense of peoplehood, which I'm guessing Ellie grew up with, where he grew up with, and certainly I did where I was, which is, first of all, we accept Jews for who they are, and then we debate the opinions that we disagree upon, and then we go and have Kiddush and have some herring together to enjoy that. And I think that is absolutely the direction that we should go in. I think the second thing where I would also agree with Ellie is we are very, very much being dragged into the culture wars. Part of this, I think, is part of the political necessity. And maybe we'll talk a little bit later also about the strands of political coalition that the religious parties are connected to, whether it be on the Haredim on the one side or Likud on the other. But we as a community, we're being dragged into making these very sort of black and white decisions. Are we on this side of the progressive divide? Are we on this side of the progressive divide? I think, like Ellie, part of what we should be bringing to the table, I think we can bring to the table with leadership like Melamed, and of course there are others, is to say, actually, let's take the issue on its merits. Let's look at and whether it's going to be around the position of spiritual leadership for women within religious communities, whether it's how we deal or cope with or accept or otherwise members of our community who may be LGBT, how we are reflecting relationship to academia or that type of scientific-based research versus Torah-based research. And there are a whole stream of communal and other debates where we have to be able to look at them on its merits and not just say, well, I happen to be in a particular camp, and therefore that's going to derive from there how I'm going to look at that issue. One final point where, again, hopefully Eli and I will agree, he brings Melech David as a kind of obviously a hero figure from the Tanakh and the way that he treated his people. I think one thing, again, which I think we can all get around is the prophetic vision for society, where repeatedly they'll say, it isn't how frum you are, it's how you treat other people. And in a 21st century modern society where we know, at least at this point, and maybe that will change, that still the majority of Jews in Israel do not accept the Shulchan Aruch and accept Torah mitzvot as the way that they are going to live, I think the way to create the society that we are looking for is to really combine around that prophetic vision of dealing with the less fortunate in our society, those who are different from us, in a way that actually can enhance God's presence within us, to invite HaKadosh Baruch Hu into our society via that prophetic vision. I think, again, probably Eli and I have a great deal to agree about on that topic.
With all of these topics, it's very clear we could continue and have an entire podcast episode on each one. So I'm going to move forward to make sure that we get to more issues, unlike last time. As long, Daniel, as you raised the issue of religious political parties, let's talk a little bit about the role of parties and politics in the religious Zionist world. Right now, I'd like to ask you a couple questions. First of all, are you satisfied with the current direction of the religious Zionist political party? It's called Tzionut HaDatit, which is religious Zionism. It has two partner parties, Osma Yehudit, run by Ben Gvir, and Noam, which together make that religious Zionist bloc. They're three separate parties that were on a single list when the elections took place. So are you satisfied with the direction that they are going? And if not, what would you like to see changed? And I'd like to add another point to that before handing it over to you, which is that before the Yom Kippur War, religious Zionism was dominated by actually a left-wing ideology, we would describe it today. In fact, as I've mentioned elsewhere, in the Six-Day War, according to Michael Oren's book, 6 Days of War, he points out that the most dovish party among those in the labor-led coalition of the time was the Mafdal, which was the old religious party, the religious Zionist party. It doesn't really exist in practice anymore, but that old religious Zionist party was the left-wing party. After 1973, the Gush Emunim, the Bloc of the Faithful, became the dominant ideology. That's the more settlement-oriented type of religious Zionism. And that became the dominant ideology both in the political party as well as, I would say, in the religious Zionist world. It changed drastically from the original more Rav Reines style, maybe we could even say Rav Soloveitchik style, even though he had not been officially the thinker that they were associated with, but it very much was along the lines of his thinking in terms of his understanding of politics. So I'm curious, first of all, as I said, do you like the direction it's going right now? And second of all, would it be helpful if there were more streams that were represented? Because it's always a good thing to have people with whom you disagree when there is a complex issue at hand.
Yeah, I don't want to do a history, a sort of historic tour. Not unlike, I think, religious streams in North America, particularly the sort of evangelical streams of Christianity in North America. After the 60s comes sort of second half of the 70s when positions which were classically held around, even there's huge amounts of research around how most of the Christian world held views around abortion, which they're completely unrecognizable relative to the political toxicity that exists around abortion in North America today. Part of this, and I think also when you look at it in that way, I think it's reflective of how we see how religious politics moved in the 70s also in Israel, was a kind of response to obviously many things which had happened during the 50s and 60s. I think also when you look at the dynamics of Gush Emunim and how that was created and the sort of the generation of Garin Gachelet, it was a group of guys in Bnei Akiva that Rav Drukman was with them. He was the Madrif. And a lot of the people that we actually see take leadership roles in the intervening period were coming of age in terms of their rabbinic positions and so forth in that period. And we're talking about, Rav Tzfania Drori and Rav Melamed and a whole series of others who actually were Talmidim of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. And they came with a a very much more radical position, not necessarily the position itself, but the sense of it is time for us to, you know, compete ideologically with what up to that point had been driven by the kibbutzim or Mapai or the other ideological parts of Zionism. And as you say, Mafdal effectively was a kind of appendage to that. And it was really, we are not going to be like the previous generation. We're going to be substantially more radical. And I think that sets on its path the switch for religious Zionism from a kind of a Rabbinist, as you say, we're religious people who are also Zionists. And that's not to undermine that Rav Reines obviously had a messianic view of the world and so on and so forth. But in his politics, he was much more secular politics that happened to be religious versus the generation which comes afterwards in the 70s and the 80s, which really sees a deep bond between the theology and the politics. And I think to a certain degree, what we see in Smotrich, which is then another generation over onto that, that is now somewhat the assumption, which is, if you look at the type of rhetoric he uses, he's now right the Treasury Minister. If you look at the rhetoric that he uses about how he sees macroeconomics, it's like Bezrat Hashem, right? I think actually, I'm not sure, but I think actually he believes that actually. Meaning, it isn't about macroeconomics and what do the economists say or the Bank of Israel or S&P or, you know, academics, but actually, don't worry, B'siyata Dishmaya, this is going to work out. And here's a but with a capital B. That is also very, very much aligned with, I think, a clear political understanding that without the very strong ties that go from the Haredi parties through Smotrich's sort of branding of religious Zionism as he has done, and the Likud, he understands that without that political coalition, he will not be able to realize the vision that he has with respect to Judea and Samaria, and you know, maybe Israeli society, whatever. You know, we can look into some of those political manifesto proposals that he has, but certainly a much more conservative view of how religious society ought to be, and of course, general society flowing from that, because everything is connected in his mind to the view that our ideology is the one that's going to drive the messianic redemption of Israel. So I think we're at a 180 degrees from where we were, as you say, sort of post 1967. Part of that is radicalization as a response both to what was going on in wider society in terms of permissiveness and so on and so forth, and also our sort of previous generation was very locked step politically with a certain view, and now we're going to do something different. Yehuda Shomron was clearly a major way to reflect that sense of radical change in politics, and I think we're still very much in that thing, but Smotrich is taking that, I think, one step further. Me personally, that leaves me out of sectoral politics, and maybe one other sentence, which we have time, we'll do today, maybe another time we'll take it separately. I think more and more people within the religious community are torn between a basic, almost a DNA of, I vote for a sectoral party because it looks out for the interests of the religious community, education, institutions, yeshivot, et cetera, and so forth. And a sense of actually the hyphenated identity that I have, which is religious and Zionist, means I actually want to vote for a general Israeli party and influence Israeli society from within mainstream politics and not as part of that sectoral thing. And if you look at the breakdown of where religious people are voting, religious Zionists, at least, forget for a second the Haredim, you see that it reflects a large percentage in Likud, a large percentage with Miflegat Tzion HaDatit, a certain percentage with Otzma Yehudit, and then also runs to the other parties who are currently not in the coalition. And I think that is going to be reflective of an internal debate we have in a religious Zionist community going forward.
Okay, thank you, Daniel. Ravelli, what do you say about that? Are you happy with the current direction of the religious Zionist party? And do you think that it should be reflective of more voices than it currently is?
I think overall, yes. I am happy with the direction, maybe not in every last possible way, but in the most important way, I think that the shift has been a very good one. And when I say the most important way, I mean our attitude towards the land and towards security. You know, the views of Rav Soloveitchik and others who were more dovish in the past You know, we live in a different world now. It's very clear that we don't have any partner in any way in Yehuda, Shomron, and Gaza, that we've experienced things. I mean, Rav Soloveitchik did not see the second intifada. You know, I almost stepped on a bus that blew up, you know, in 2002. I just missed a bus that blew up and saw the bodies and sat with the family, you know, that night. I remember being a college student. I was 22. We saw that. We experienced that. How many Jews have to die? And what we've just seen on October 7th, they did not experience that. And I think it's gone in a very good direction in terms of being a voice of clarity in Israel for who it is that we're up against, the enemy that we're up against. Right? And we're the ones who are telling the rest of Israel that these people want to kill us. And the fact is, we know better than anyone else, because the majority of the people who are living in Yehuda and Shomron are part of this religious Zionist community. We see it firsthand. We deal with these people, unfortunately, firsthand. So on that front, I actually don't wish that there is more diversity in terms of the national security front, because I think the more people who think that we, and continue to, in my view, delude themselves into thinking that we can have peace with these people, right, the more, unfortunately, more Jews will die, right? Until the Jewish people in Israel figure this out and become 100% clear, right, we're going to have more dead Jews. And so on that front, I really don't want. On other issues, I do think it is a good thing to have diversity. In general, right, Rav Kook was very clear that we need different Jews. And even those tribes of Israel who we think are wrong in certain significant ways, you know, they bring benefit to the people of Israel. So, you know, maybe I'm not exactly thrilled about the Noam, you know, culture war kind of element of religious Zionism. Maybe we spoke about that earlier. I don't think that's necessary. I think you can have those views. I may agree with them on those views. I just don't like the way that they go about them. But overall, I do think that it's a good thing that the religious Zionist community has become more realistic and clear about who the enemy that we're up against.
Maybe just a couple of points which are relevant. I do agree. I think it's somewhat anachronistic to try and figure out what Rav Soloveitchik would think about politics if he was still around, saying, of course, for Rav Kook and others. I would agree with Ellie that you know, circumstances change, therefore the politics must move along with that. It is worth mentioning, in case anybody is under the wrong impression, the vast majority of the people who were murdered, kidnapped, raped on the 7th of October obviously were not in Yehuda v'Shomron. And I do think that there are communities, political communities outside of the religious Zionist community, who do understand the reality that we live in, but it does lead them to different political consequences and decisions. But I think where we started the first podcast is that on the whole, you can assume that 85 to 90% of the religious community sits somewhere on the right wing spectrum when it comes to security and political issues. But I think there is a vast spectrum of views when it comes to social issues like state and religion, the religious girls going to the army, or girls in general being in the army and holding, you know, various different positions, whether it's in battle positions or others, academia, other issues around culture, LGBT, and so forth. And part of the research that we have done at the Institute that I was part of the founding of, we're actually trying to parse those questions so that people can feel very comfortable with their political position, I'm right wing, and understand I can still be religious and have a range of you know, social identities in terms of how I relate to some of these other questions. And go back to the sort of example that we got before with Rav Melamed. I think on the whole, what we tend to find is that within the rabbinic higher echelons, it won't be completely shocking to discover they tend to hold fairly conservative views within that. But I think actually a large part of the community is actually quite distant from some of those positions. By the way, one of the things which we've seen since October the 7th is a major, an additional shift, but a major shift on the question of whether Dati girls should be going to the army and whether they should be in battle positions. And both the Datiim and the Masortiim have shifted in that sense in a positive, again, if you view that as a positive thing. In fact, anecdotally, I can tell you that Aluma, which is the an organization which supports girls during their decision-making process pre the army, immediately after the 7th of October, about 150 girls who had basically, you have to, in this country, if you're religious, you have the opportunity, one might say the privilege, to say, well, I opt for religious reasons not to go to the army. I'm going to do short term. I will do national service. But you have to sign a document saying I'm basically signing out of the process of conscription, and instead I'm going to Shirut Leumi. About 150 girls who had signed up for Shirut Leumi basically retracted that signature and then switched to go to the army. And one of the things which is super interesting to look at is the difference and often the dynamic between a sort of top-down, rabbinically led approach to modernity and a bottom-up, how the community actually deals with it on a practical basis. And I think that where some of these religious feminist issues go, I think they more speak to bottom-up than they do from top-down.
I want to move forward only because we don't have that much time and I still have a few things I want to get to. And of course, there's more that we won't get to, but we'll do the best we can. Ellie, let me ask you your opinion about one of the most important issues that has been coming up recently, in particular, over the past week or two. Rav Yitzchak Yosef, the chief rabbi, the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, mentioned that along the lines of, I'm not going to quote him, but along the lines that if Haredi conscription into the military is mandatory, then the Haredim will get up and leave the country. And, of course, there was a very well-known and painful response by Rav Tamir Granot. He is a Rosh Yeshiva, or one of the Rosh Yeshiva, along with Rav Yuval Shurlo, in Orot Shaul, a yeshiva my son Netanel actually attends. Rav Granot, his son, was tragically killed in the north towards the beginning of the war. And he had a response in a YouTube video, which has been seen widely, where he said his wife cried for 24 hours after hearing that. It was a very painful watch, and people really should see it if they can. And Ravelli, what's your feeling about Haredi conscription and the way that religious Zionists should relate to that question? Because obviously, we in the religious Zionist world believe that while Torah learning is obviously very important, we also believe that serving in the IDF is a mitzvah and something that everyone should do. How should we relate to the current Haredi? And again, that's a broad term. There are people who don't agree with this in the Haredi world. But for the sake of time, let's call it the general Haredi insistence that they are not going to serve in the IDF.
Well, first, I would say about Rav Granot's video that it's one of the most powerful videos I've seen in my life. And I do hope that somebody soon, you know, translates it and so people can watch it with English subtitles, because it's something that should be required watching for everyone. Look, I'm a religious Zionist. I believe that we all have an obligation to serve in the army. And frankly, I'll start by saying that I live with constant guilt. I actually believe that I think, like Rabbi Rakefet believes, that every single Jew has an obligation to serve in the army, wherever you live in the world. So I was not an Israeli citizen until only 3 years ago, but I do believe that I have an obligation. I had an obligation. I didn't realize it at the time. I didn't fully grasp it as an 18, 19, 20-year-old, but I had an obligation to serve, and I will live with that guilt for the rest of my life. I don't think they want me now. I have bad knees and probably could lose some weight. So I'm not exactly, you know, the person they're looking for right now, but I will say that. And I think, you know, it's something that I do live with, and every Jew has an obligation. This is a Milchemes Mitzvah. You know, as Moshe Rabbeinu said, how can you, you know, your brother is going to go to war and you're going to stay here? I mean, it simply can't be, right? It simply, and you know, all the greats of Jewish history, from Avraham Avinu to Moshe Rabbeinu to Yehoshua to David, all of them, right? They all valued Torah learning, certainly. But so I am sure that Daniel and I agree on this front, that the Haredi position is really untenable. That being said, the real question is not whether, you know, we agree with the Haredim. The question is, how do we deal with it? And I do think that we have an obligation to be thoughtful, right? I saw that, you know, there's people like to sometimes say, you know, peace now, or recruit all the Haredim now, or all the hostages must go now. Obviously, those are all things we want. We all want peace. And I think all of us on this call probably want the Haredim to serve. And we all of us want the hostages home right now. But there's a danger in saying that, because when you say now, right, that makes the issue oversimplified, right? There are complexities here, and it can cause a lot of damage if you say we're going to do peace now at all costs, or if we're going to recruit Haredim now at all costs. So that's certainly not the way. And I don't think that anyone who's really thoughtful about this and wants this to succeed and is not just angry would say that it all has to happen all at once. I mean, that's simply not possible. You know, we have to understand where the Haredim are coming from. I think, you know, I disagree very strongly with their outlook on life. But their view of the world is very, very different from ours. I mean, they idealize exile and what came before. But I think the rest of us in Israel, whether Dati Leumi or secular, we look at what happened in Europe and say, thank God we're not there anymore. And thank God we could defend ourselves, right? We think it was a disaster in Europe, what happened. Thank God we have an IDF. And so we look at the IDF as something that we are so deeply fortunate to have. But for Haredim, you know, their whole view of life is perpetuation, right? They idealize exile, right? They kind of gloss over the fact that so many people were going off the path in Europe. I mean, the idealized Europe that they've created and that they teach about has simply never existed. It was a disaster religiously in Europe before the war. But in their minds, they've created a picture that Europe was this incredible place and the exile was wonderful. And so they've just continued, perpetuated their exile in Israel. And so therefore, they don't have this national outlook that we have. And in fact, the IDF, which is power and the opposite of exile, the opposite of powerlessness. So the IDF represents everything they disagree with. Right. And on top of that, they have this exile perspective. They don't look at the world as, you know, that we're a nation, right? They don't look at Am Yisrael in that way. They're very focused on their kehilah. And that's how Rav Yosef could say such a thing, because he's thinking about, he's not looking at Am Yisrael, he's looking at his particular kehilah. And he thinks if it's best for his kehilah and his view, right, well, then we'll pick up our kehilah and go somewhere else. We think that's absurd, and it is absurd. I don't mean to attack him personally. He's a very holy man. But that view, that whole outlook on life is so radically different from ours, and we have to recognize that. Until that outlook can begin to change and Haredim can begin to realize that we have an Am, that we have to care about Am Yisrael, we're going to have a lot of trouble with that shift. And so, I honestly think that I would be very happy with the beginnings of a shift. If there was, even if they didn't go to the army right away, if there was some sort of national service that they began to do, or even if, I believe the Netziv says this, I have to look it up again, it's been some years since I saw it, even if they took their Torah learning to the army bases, right? I think the Netziv says that Yisachar would learn in the army bases, and mostly Yisachar probably did not serve. I think they only sent some soldiers, and most of them were learning, but they did so in the tents in the army base, right? That would send such a powerful message to the people of Israel that they care. And I think the big problem right now is that there's a sense that many don't care. Many do. There are many wonderful Haredim out there who are doing a lot of chesed. But overall, I think Rabbi Yitzhak Adlerstein wrote about this. He doesn't sense the urgency. He doesn't sense the pain that he should be sensing. He writes very, very powerfully about this. And in a way that I can't, because I'm not a member of that community at all. I think, you know, Rabbi Adlerstein is like a modern Haredi person. And so he can at least write to some degree as an insider. And if he's writing that, he's writing that with great pain. I think there's a deep, deep brokenness that has to be addressed. And you know, how to go about that, how to begin shifting that hashkafa, which I believe is broken, meaning the people are wonderful. The Haredi world is holy. There's so many amazing people. But sadly, I think it's a broken hashkafa, which is wrong. And how to go about fixing that, that's a great question. I'm just a Jew in a frat. On that one, I'm really, really not sure.
Okay, thank you. Daniel, how about you? What's your opinion about this?
Yeah, I'm going to carry on really from the point where Ellie stopped, because I think probably he and I agree on so far everything that he has said. For those who have access, I think, to Hebrew, Elchanan Nir in Makor Rishon wrote a fantastic piece specifically about this, and also in response, obviously, to not just to what Rav Yosef had said, and let's just remember, he is the Rav Rashi, okay? Again, as religious Zionists, you know, we attach more than just a kind of bureaucratic importance to that position. And it's a desecration, frankly, of his role, his responsibility, what he represents, to say something like that. And the lack of criticism, the outcry against that from within his own community and even from parts of our community, I think needs a response. But Elchanan Nir, as much as he was addressing the Haredi community, I think he was addressing the religious Zionist community. And I think here is a crucial point, which I suspect we're going to get to. The classic response, and indeed the leader of the religious Zionist party, Bezalel Smotrich himself, said, well, you know, those that learn Torah should stay learning Torah. This is going to take some time. And everything we should do, bihidavrut, only through consensus. And as somebody who spent many years both with Geshe, which totally believes in consensus building and so forth, and I'm very active with the Haredi community on a number of different initiatives, I have a great desire to do things via consensus. But Elchanan Nir makes a very specific set of points. He said, politically, it's clear that we rely on the support of the Haredim in order to protect other political interests, and therefore the religious community and its leaders are going to have to make tough decisions about that political alliance and covenant, which has just got deeper over the years. Okay, so there is even, and again, without getting into the nuances, part of the more conservative, more religious parts of the religious Zionist community, I think, genuinely begin to identify with learning forever as a kind of core value over and above even other values. And I think Smotrich definitely is moving in that direction. We as a community are going to have to make some difficult political decisions of whether we're going to keep with that or we're going to separate on that basis. And the second thing which he says is, yes, obviously, I don't think anybody in Israel is going to move to a position where the military police is going to be picking up boys from Ponovich and taking them to the army. I don't think anybody considers that as any sort of reality. But we do have specific political levers, particularly economic ones, which if the Haredim as politicians were isolated, and indeed you had the Tzionut Datit plus the Likud, plus obviously all of the other parties currently in opposition agreeing that says, we're not going to take anybody in the back of a police car to the army, but we're not going to continue funding what is effectively a narrative which is undermining our existential security. And by the way, it's obvious after the 7th of October, but it was 100% true on the 6th of October as well. And it will continue to be true even when we have defeated our enemies in Gaza and, God forbid, in if there is a war in the north. And so I do think that we have crossed over a sort of point in time within our own community where we're going to have to make difficult political decisions about which of our political priorities is more important than the other. And that, I think, is going to be reflected in the debate that we have within the community over the coming months and maybe years. Elchanan Nir definitely put it very succinctly. If people like Rav Tamir, who also has very deep and long-term connections with the Haredi community, feels that he's forced to say in the way that he did during that video that we've all seen, then I think we are beginning to see a shift in our, within the community, about how that is going to be reflected with the Haredim going forward.
We're almost out of time, but I want to make sure that some of the points you mentioned now we address. And in particular, you talked about the fact that he is Rav HaRashi, namely he is the official chief rabbi of the State of Israel, and the pain and the hurt that his words have caused many people in what was obviously a sectarian announcement for his own people when he's supposed to represent the entire country. Let me ask, in a general sense, your feelings, both of you, about the combination of Torah and state together. The idea that Torah law is, at least in part, specifically when it comes to issues of conversion, marriage, and divorce, the law of the land, whether that's a good thing, and I'm asking this obviously in your positions as religious Zionists, and whether that's something which religious Zionists, in your view, should support, or if it's something which should actually be discouraged because sometimes it leads to conclusions and unintended consequences that even people who care deeply about halakha would not be happy with. Rav Eli, let's start with you. What's your feeling about that?
This is one of those very, very tough issues because, you know, as Americans, we cut, you know, and Daniel, we all come from other places. And, you know, in America, this is something we're simply not used to, right? We're used to some more of a separation and things being privatized. And that's certainly in many ways easier, right? We certainly don't live in, you know, in the era of, you know, the late 1800s where, you know, the government was tied up together with religion and all the complexities that came from that and all the problems that came from that. And so that's, you know, that's what we were born with, and it's natural for us. On the other hand, you know, we have a unique situation with the Jewish state, and I think it would be too simple to say, oh, let's just do what America does here. It would solve some significant issues, and certainly corruption in the rabbinate and all those things are very, very troubling to me, very upsetting to me. I'm sure Daniel agrees with all of that as well. Like, they're very, very upsetting, but, you know, but then there are significant national issues that we're simply not America, right? This is not just a democratic republic that's without any particular tie to any particular religion. We're the one Jewish state in the world. And frankly, you know, there are national issues, and conversion is one of those. And, you know, so how to balance these two, I think, you know, we as Olim, I think, What I would suggest probably for the moment is that we do need to continue to have a national rabbinate, but we do have to work to reform it and to try to somehow find the best of both worlds, to privatize what can be privatized, but and what has to remain national, to try to make sure that it's done in a way that is proper and a Kiddush Hashem instead of, unfortunately, what often is the case is a Chilul Hashem. So I'm not getting overly detailed because this is another one of those really, really difficult issues and we don't have a lot of time, but now that's my overall attitude.
I grew up very much steeped in the basic idea that the rabbinate is much more than this bureaucratic institution, and it is somehow a reflection of getting closer to the redemptive state. I will be honest with you both and say that I think I actually see it now as the opposite, unfortunately, and the level of damage that the rabbinate does to people's respect for Judaism itself and even Jewish observance. I think it actually, in the corporate world, we might call it a value killer rather than a value creator. So there's more, I think Judaism is actually being destroyed by these types of statements, and it's pushing people away from their Judaism. I think I would make two other comments. Number one, Rav Tzvi Yehuda himself was very clear that theologically, there is little value to the keeping mitzvot if you're doing it under duress, if you're actually being, if there's kfiyah. And he very much believed, I think actually incredibly radical in the way that he writes about that, that actually there is little value in having people keep mitzvot if they're only doing so because effectively the secular state through the rabbinate is forcing them to do so. So I don't just think, I've sort of rethought my position with respect to the rabbinate over the last number of years. With that in mind, like almost at a more philosophical level, what type of Jewish observance do we want in Israel across the board? And how much can that be based around the choice and love of people for Judaism, not because the Knesset has empowered what is effectively a Haredi chief rabbinate in order to do that? I think also the practical maybe point that I would suggest for us to think about is, I agree with Ellie, we can't be American. I would be the last person on the planet who would want us to look like America, of course. But I do think we can divest some of the centralized power that is within the rabbinate down into a wider spectrum of communal Judaism, even at the risk of communities who are not strictly Orthodox, who fit in even to a Bet Hillel or a Tzohar view of the world, would say, we are a community, we want Jewish observance, we want to do it the way that we want to. I think actually empowering people to make that choice at the level of community, neighborhood, city, et cetera, first of all, I think will reduce the level of corruption that we have. I think it will allow communities to have a wider spectrum of Jewish expression. I think overall, it would actually increase the amount of free choice and desire for Judaism relative to who we are today. Just to finish off, since we have connected it up to politics on a couple of occasions, if there's one element that the Mifleget Tzionut Hadatit, I think, takes and is pushing, which is ultimately 100% in opposition to what I've just said, it is in this point, which is that actually they would like to centralize even more halachic decision-making within the rabbinate and give them additional power. And I think actually we should be moving into a position where we reduce that power and allow a much wider reflection of people's genuine Jewish desire at the level of the community.
Okay, we are out of time, and I am so appreciative that you have given your time and so generous the second podcast. Of course, people will say, but you didn't talk about this issue or that issue. I know we'll have to have at some point another conversation because there's so much to talk about. But let me just ask you each for your final thoughts. Ellie?
Right. I would just point out, with all the debate about the future of religious Zionism, let's all pause and reflect on the greatness of our community. Right. We are, yes, you could say that we're sectarian in a certain sense. We have our yeshivas and our places. But if you give money to a Hezder yeshiva, you're not just giving money to the religious Zionist community. You are building the future of this entire nation. Right? We are our group, our relatively small minority of religious Zionists, like what we have done in this war, the sacrifice, the love, what we are doing is kind of bringing secular soldiers closer to Judaism in such an incredible way. Our soldiers, we're seeing our greatest generation, incredible young religious Zionists who are open-hearted and sharing Torah in all the very best ways, sacrificing so much. We have so much to be proud of. I think I mentioned this last time, but I would say again, we are, and it comes with great responsibility, but I believe we are the leading tribe, so to speak, of Israel. We are the tribe of Yehuda. We are the tribe of Judah. And it comes with, again, with awesome responsibility. I don't say this with arrogance, but I think that we have to lead, and we should be incredibly, incredibly proud of our community with whatever flaws we have. And of course, we're not perfect, but I just know that I am humbled every day to be part of this. I'm relatively new to it. Living here in Israel only 3 years, and I can't even tell you how awed I am by the people that I am, that I live among. It's really, really incredible. Reb Shlomo Katz, you know, had an amazing, amazing point. You know, I live around the corner from him, and he said in shul, you know, we always see in so many shuls, Dalifnei mi ata omeid, right? Know before whom you were standing. And maybe it's a little scary to us when we were younger, or maybe even a little bit scary now. But Reb Shlomo said, I thought this was such an amazing insight. We should stop saying that. And instead we should say, Da imi ata omeid. Know among whom you are standing. I find myself standing among soldiers, among fathers and mothers who can't sleep at night because they have kids in the army. And the strength and the faith, it's just absolutely astounding. And it's for this reason, I think, you know, if you're an American and you call yourself modern Orthodox, it's time to move on. Be a religious Zionist. What we are seeing here in this country today, it's absolutely redemptive. This tribe that we are a part of, this leading tribe of Israel, is absolutely incredible. And I'm honored to be a small part of it.
I am proud of the community that I certainly belong to. I maybe would take a slightly more circumspect view, as I think we reflected in the first podcast. But maybe I'll take Ellie's point and move forward with it and say, I think if we generally want to be a community that stands shoulder to shoulder, not just with ourselves, but with the rest of Israeli society, we are going to need a different leadership that actually understands deeply how that can take place, because the direction that the leadership is taking us is actually more isolationist and separatist, and less around an integrated view of standing shoulder to shoulder with our Moti and Chiloni and maybe even Haredi friends and brothers in how to actually achieve the dreams that we want for this country. It doesn't take anything away from the contribution that the community makes and has shown in an unbelievable way over the last number of months, and I'm sure we'll continue to do going forward. But I think it requires a slightly different level of maturity from a leadership perspective in order to turn that into something which actually can bring it to full expression within wider society, which I'm sure we all hope for.
Okay, well, both of you, I really appreciate you joining me, Rabbi Elie Michel, Daniel Goldman, thanks again.
Great, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Subscribe to The Orthodox Conundrum on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. Please visit jewishcoffeehouse.com for other episodes of The Orthodox Conundrum, as well as many other great podcasts, including Intimate Judaism, The Maimonides Minute, Chochmat Nashim, The Francisca Show, and Let My People Eat. I'd appreciate it if you go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review The Orthodox Conundrum. It takes literally 2 minutes. It's just giving a certain number of stars and writing one or two sentences. Please like the Orthodox Conundrum podcast on Facebook and join our growing Facebook group, the Orthodox Conundrum Discussion Group, where you can feel free to discuss issues in Orthodoxy in an honest and friendly environment. I hope you'll become a Jewish Coffeehouse patron on Patreon. Just click on the link in the description of this podcast, and you can get bonus episodes, Jewish Coffeehouse merch, and more. You'll get special episodes on all sorts of topics that are only available to subscribers, and you'll be helping Jewish Coffeehouse spread our message of a welcoming, intellectually engaged, and honest Orthodoxy. Just join Patreon. It's only a couple of dollars a month, and you can stop anytime, so join today. Finally, do you have a message that needs to get out? Do you want to promote your business, your organization, or your cause? The best way is by producing a podcast, and Jewish Coffee House can make it happen. I have experience producing hundreds of podcasts, both for myself and for satisfied clients. Whether you want to learn everything you need in one day, or relax and record and let me do the heavy lifting, Jewish Coffee House Productions will work with you to make it happen and make it even better than you imagined. Let me help you today. Write to me at scott@jewishcoffeehouse.com or go to jewishcoffeehouse.com, click on Productions, and sign up for a free consultation. Make your voice heard, promote your cause, sell your product, and engage an audience now. I'm Scott Kahn. This has been the Orthodox Conundrum on jewishcoffeehouse.com.